When I first looked at the lesson this week, I'm like, you know, that's really a strange story in some ways. And so where are we going to go with this? That's what I asked myself. I said, yep, that's what happened. You know, he got bit by a snake, but nothing happened. Where do we go with this? I've covered this many times, but in a broader context. So hopefully what we'll do tonight will insert this in our study of miracles and look at the specific event, but also see it in the broader context of what God's doing in miracles in the New Testament. So, but glad to be with all of you. Zach, would you lead our prayer to start us with?
Our dear Father in heaven, we thank you for the beautiful day that you bless us with. We thank you for the safe travels we've had to get here tonight. We ask you to bless us in our study tonight. Help us to be attentive and help us to learn much from what we study of your word. We ask you to be with Philip as he leads us and help him to readily recall the things that he's prepared. We ask you to be with those who are unable to be here. If they're sick, we ask you to heal them. If they're traveling, we ask you to grant them a safe journey. We ask you to be with those who are unable to get out due to concerns about COVID, and we ask you to bless them, and may you shape things to allow them to return to us soon. And most of all, we thank you for sending your son, Jesus, to die upon the cross for the remission of our sins. It's in his name we pray. Amen.
Amen. So, when last we were studying in the book of Acts and studying about Paul and miracles, we see that Paul is actually finishing up what we call his third missionary journey. And he's headed back east. He's headed back toward Palestine. He's actually headed toward Jerusalem. He's headed toward Jerusalem, but he's going to stop along the way and see Christians and meet with them. And so that's what happens in Troas there when we learn Sunday about them meeting to break bread on the first day of the week and that happening to Eutychus. He's on his way back, but he's hitting places where he feels a need to interact with some Christians and give them teaching or encouragement, something like that. But he's going back to Jerusalem. Paul does those circuits where he goes from the eastern part of the Mediterranean, usually to the northern part, and back. We've seen that. We'll look at a map in a moment. There's another specific reason why Paul is headed back. He's got a gift. There had been a famine predicted in Judea, and Gentile Christians throughout the territories where Paul had been preaching had been gathering up funds to send back to those needy saints. And so that is in part one of the things that Paul is doing. He's facilitating the bringing of that gift to the Judean brethren. There's so many layers to the book of Acts. You know, the gospel radiates from Jerusalem out. And the gospel is taken from there, from the Jewish communities to the Gentile communities. And now this offering of love and concern is rebounding back to them. That's so fitting, isn't it? And actually, Paul makes that same appeal in his really his second letter to the Corinthians about that, why it's proper for those Gentile Christians to do this for their Jewish brethren. So Paul is headed back to Jerusalem. So what happens there? Because we're going to end up back on the other side of the Mediterranean by the time we finish here tonight with him reaching into some sticks and getting bitten by a snake. So how does all this happen? Well, I think it's so important to see this event in the context. None of these events are happening in a vacuum. And I think that's where this may seem like a random kind of story, but it's not. It's part of the fabric of what's going on. So he returns to Jerusalem, as we talked about a moment ago, and the reasons why. And immediately there are some issues. So I want us to look at Acts chapter 21 to set the stage. So go back over there with me to Acts 21. And Elaine, can you read those verses for us? Acts 21, 20 to 22. Acts 21, 20 to 22. Paul has gotten to Jerusalem and the Christians there are concerned.
And when they heard it, they began glorifying God. And they said to him, "You see, brother, how many thousands there are among the Jews of those who have believed, and they are all zealous for the law. And they have been told about you, and you are teaching all the Jews who are among the Gentiles to forsake Moses, telling them not to circumcise their children, nor to walk according to the customs. What then is to be done? They will certainly hear it if you come.
All right, thank you. Paul reports back about his travels, working in the synagogues and meeting Jews along the way, but also the news about the Gentiles receiving salvation. But the word got back. So, yeah, they didn't have telephones. They didn't have internet. They didn't have instant messenger or Facebook or nothing like that. We would be mistaken to underestimate the speed and the expansiveness of communication in the first century here. And it doesn't match ours, obviously, because of the technology, but it is marvelously efficient. And so Paul had a reputation. But you know how reputations are, right? Sometimes they are deserved, sometimes they are partly deserved, sometimes they're not deserved at all. And so all that they're hearing is that Paul's going around doing what?
Teaching people not to keep the law.
Right. Now, is this an accurate assessment of what Paul was doing? Not really, is it? Okay. He certainly is trying to convert people from believing that they are the people of God through being Israelites to being followers of Christ and faith in Christ. But there are many things about the teachings of Moses that are moral teachings that are found in the gospel and things such as that. And it's also, it's implying that there's some kind of disdain for the ways of Moses and the teachings of Moses. And Paul does not do that. Paul continues to practice some things customarily as a Jew because of his ethnicity. If you think about the dress and the food and some of those kinds of things are incidental to the gospel anyway. So it's not a complete picture, but basically Paul's being painted as a what? How would you fill the blank in? Among the Jewish people, he's painted as a what?
Traitor.
Troublemaker. That's right. Disturber of the peace, agitator, all those kinds of things. So, and actually, he's been warned before he got to Jerusalem that this would not end well if he went to Jerusalem. But he does. So he is a polarizing figure, and he's in Jerusalem. Well, sure enough, he's at the temple involved in a Jewish custom. He's not tossing the whole thing. It's not the path to salvation. He makes that very clear in his writings, like the book of Romans. But he is not, you know, completely disdainful of the customs of Moses. He's in the temple. It's assumed some people with him are Gentiles. They're not. He doesn't think anybody who's a Gentile in the area where the Gentiles couldn't go in the temple court area. And so there is a mob that sets upon Paul. And this goes over, what I'm listing here goes over a few chapters, and it's very dramatic. But he's, because there is a mob that forms, he's taken into Roman protective custody. Now, you know that the Jewish people had their own government, the Jewish Sanhedrin Council, and they had some independence, they had some self-government, but they were an occupied country, an occupied people. The Romans occupied Palestine all up and down it. They allowed some self-rule, but the Romans were the ultimate authority, and they had soldiers there, and they had officials there in Jerusalem, and especially close to the temple, they had a fortress. And so when the Romans see a mob, they rush in to quell the mob. That's one thing the Romans didn't tolerate. They didn't tolerate public disturbances. They didn't like them. They crushed them. They were really good at that. And so they swoop right down and free Paul from this mob. They're going to take him into protective custody. Before that, though, Paul asked permission to stand on the steps and to speak to the crowd that was about to just Shanghai him. He stops and tells them the story of his conversion and tries to appeal to them to understand, you know, that Jesus is the Christ and so forth. So he's taken into Roman custody. He has a hearing before the Jewish council, which sort of just doesn't go anywhere. And then the Roman authorities learn that there's a plot to kill Paul. Again, they don't want trouble. They've learned that Paul has a Roman citizenship that we've noted before in this class. It's come up. And so they need to give him full protection. They feel like they keep him in Jerusalem. This is not going to be good. And with a huge contingency of soldiers, including on horses, Paul is given an escort. And he is taken to Caesarea. So Here's Jerusalem. But understand, in this area, at one time, Herod, and we'll talk about this in just a second. At one time, Herod basically ruled all of this for the Romans. But that's during the days of Jesus' birth and so forth. Herod the Great dies. And then basically his kingdom is divided up among some of his descendants. But this part, Judea, because it was such a hotbed of political unrest, this area becomes ruled directly by a Roman governor. And so it is by the time of Jesus. And who's the Roman governor at the time of Jesus' trial and execution? Pontius Pilate. But understand, the Roman governors, though they came up to Jerusalem, up meaning up in elevation. It's like you can, you know, you got it, okay. I was doing it, let's do a local illustration. I need to lay off that until I really get my geography down here. That's okay. Hang on to that. So they would go up to Jerusalem at certain times, like feast days. That's why Pilate was in Jerusalem at the Passover when Jesus is tried. But their operations was based in Caesarea. Right there on the coast, this was the Roman provincial capital. They built a really nice place, nice layout for the Roman governor, huge amount of military there. This is their base of operations. You can see why it's on the coast. And so this is Caesarea, and you can see the name, get it, Roman provincial capital. There he's examined by the first governor, Felix. This is the same position that Pontius Pilate had. The Pilate's gone. He's no longer governor of Palestine by the time of Paul. So Felix examines him, keeps him in custody. Then Felix is replaced by a governor by the name of Festus. He examines Paul. These are fascinating interactions. Festus is the one that allows a contingency of Jewish prosecutors to come down to Caesarea and present their case. And they're trying to get Festus to let them have a trial back in Jerusalem. And Festus is leaning that way. Festus is leaning to sending Paul back to Jerusalem. Well, Paul knows that's not good. So what does Paul do? Anybody know?
He appeals to Caesar.
Appeals to Caesar because he has that right as a Roman citizen. So he appeals to Caesar. And so Festus has no choice but to concede to this and send him on his way. Before that happens, though, and this is... And I've got a sermon on this, and one of these days I'll preach it for you, but I'll improve it, and then I'll preach it. But it's such a fascinating interaction between Paul and King Herod Agrippa II, who was a descendant of Herod the Great. I think he was a grandson of Herod the Great. He's a nephew of the Herod that killed John the Baptist. I think that's right. So he's a relative to this family that's just had a nasty kind of track record with God's people. And Paul has this audience with him. And King Agrippa wants to hear from Paul. He's heard about Paul. He's fascinated. And so all this pomp, you know, is celebrated, and they parade Paul in. And it's just an incredible contrast, an incredible moment here. So he's examined by King Herod Agrippa. They have a very dramatic interaction there. But of course, Paul has appealed to Caesar. And so to Caesar he's going to go, as Festus says. So Paul is given to a Roman centurion. We would consider that in today's terms, those of you with military experience, sort of a mid-level officer. And like a captain, something like that. And there are other prisoners with Paul besides the centurion. And they set sail for Rome. Now let's talk about sailing for a moment. Understand that at this point in human history, when you set out to the ocean, you hug the coast. You stay pretty close to the coast. One of the few places in the world where they headed out into the open ocean was the Mediterranean. The reason you did not go out to the open ocean is that they did not have the navigational tools to know where they were going. Nor were the ships that seaworthy to go out what we would call the Atlantic or the Pacific or even on the Indian Ocean. They're starting to probe out and use the monsoons on the Indian Ocean. They're going to improve that in the next few centuries. But Mediterranean is one of those places because it's a lake. You're going to end up somewhere close to land. So they actually did head out into the Mediterranean, but they still hugged pretty close to the land. I mean, they would sometimes, you know, go down here or go up there, but they stayed pretty close to the land. But sometimes they would head out into the open ocean because it's not very far to land, such as from Palestine here to Cyprus or somewhere like that. So that's the kind of sea travel that you've got here with the Apostle Paul. So they're going to make their way, and they do. This is a general passenger ship. Think in terms of an ocean liner, a lot smaller scale. Think in terms of a jet liner where you've got people from, you know, crisscrossing and traveling and all headed in one direction right now. There's a combination of, you know, business people and government officials and who knows. And that's what you've got here. But you've got some prisoners. You've got some Roman military people, and you've got Paul, and you've got some other passengers. They make it to Crete right here. Paul encourages them to stay at Fair Havens. He tells them, don't leave here. They have to winter somewhere. They have to stop for a couple of months to winter because the seas are too rough to make this passage. And Paul says we shouldn't leave here. But Fair Havens was not as nice of a port as this one right here on the western side of Crete, Phoenix. And that's where the Roman officer wanted to go. It was a nicer place. It was a better harbor. If you've got to spend 2 months somewhere, do you want to be in an armpit or do you want to be in a nice place? So they try to make it to this side of Crete, and a storm blows in. From the north, an early winter storm throws them off course, and they are thrown out into the middle of the Mediterranean. The only time you would ever go out in here is during the time of the year when the weather was calm, where you can control, you know, your course a little better and end up somewhere around here. I mean, look at this. If you're going that way, there's a good chance you're going to hit land, right? But they head out in here, and they have no control of the ship. There is a storm at sea that lasts for days and days and days, and it's bad. It's really bad. Now, maybe you've been in a situation sort of like that. I don't know. I'm not ever going to get in one of those. I get seasick. I got woozy one time in the bottom of an aircraft carrier that was docked in San Diego Bay. It was docked. An aircraft carrier. 3 football fields long. And I was down in the hold getting a tour, and I got a little woozy because it was like barely moving. So I can't imagine this. I can't. I'd be like Jonah, just throw me over. Okay? End it, okay? This is bad. And it is a sort of a Jonah kind of thing. It's also a similar part of the world where the Jonah thing happened. Okay? So let's read what happens. I mean, it is as bad as it's going to get. I mean, some of these people are seasoned Mediterranean Sea goers. And it's bad. Really bad. So, Acts 27, starting in verse 20. Can you read that for us, Rick, down to verse 26?
And since neither sun nor stars appeared for many days, and no small storm was assailing us, from then on, all hope of our being saved was gradually abandoned. And when they had gone a long time without food, then Paul stood up in their midst and said, "Men, you ought to have followed my advice and not to have set sail from Crete and incurred this damage and loss. And yet now I urge you to keep up your courage, for there shall be no loss of life among you, but only of the ship. For this very night an angel of the God to whom I belong and whom I serve stood before me, saying, 'Do not be afraid, Paul. You must stand before Caesar. And behold, God has granted you all those who are sailing with you. Therefore, keep up your courage, men, for I believe God that it will turn out exactly as I have been told. But we must run aground on a certain island.'"
Why are they not taking food? That's why some people take a cruise, right?
Well,
okay, they're having to lighten the load, one issue. Nothing superfluous on that ship. They also don't know what. How long they're going to be out there. There's a difference between hunger and starvation. They're willing to endure hunger so they do not starve to death later. You'll see in a few verses that Paul actually tells them to take food and gives thanks for the food. What role is Paul in this situation? What role does he just, what I'm looking for, he just sort of steps into it?
Leadership.
Yeah. This reminds us of what? What other incident we studied a few lessons ago? Where he said, it's okay, we're all here.
The jail.
Yeah, Philippi. When the jail was rocked by the earthquake, but yet prisoners didn't escape, and Paul says, we're all here. He speaks for them. Paul becomes a leader in this. Paul's a prisoner on this boat. And he gets away with it. They acquiesce to this. I'm not saying that Paul is becoming authoritative and trying to boss them. It's servant leadership. But it's leadership. So impressive here what happens. And Paul says, you know, we shouldn't have done this. But Paul assures them, as Rick just read, there's not going to be loss of life. So sure enough, they run the ship aground. The ship begins to break up because it's stuck into the hard surface, and the stern, the back of the boat, is being broken up. And so they all have to jump overboard, and they get to shore. Let's read that part. Keep reading, Rick. 27, verses 42 to 44.
And the soldiers' plan was to kill the prisoners, that none of them should swim away and escape. But the centurion, wanting to bring Paul safely through, kept them from their intention and commanded that those who could swim should jump overboard first and get to land. And the rest should follow, some on planks and others on various things from the ship. And thus it happened that they were all brought safely to land.
Again, Paul secures all the soldiers, all the prisoners in the situation. Just like in Philippi. And how many made it safely to land, either by swimming or floating? All. They all made it, just like Paul said they would, because he had been assured by the Lord that they would. So, they end up right here, Malta. Little island there. It's an independent nation today. That's where they're at. I mean, it's like a speck. On this map, it's a speck. So, I mean, this is like, they are fortunate. Of course, we know something else is at work here, don't we? Which is where this is ultimately going. So, they get ashore. I mean, I want you to think about this. Think about this. Paul has been, when we first started this list, Paul was attacked by a mob, taken into Roman custody, about to be beaten. Then he's eventually, you know, he's put through these examinations and trials. At any point, the Romans can do about anything to him. I mean, they could provide some kind of process, due process, and charge him with something. You know, they could charge him with something. In all fairness to the Romans were pretty good legally. What happened to Jesus was, I would propose to you, an anomaly. They were pretty just. Now, eventually, the Roman government will get very heavy-handed with Christians, and they will with Paul, because they're just tired of the disruptions. But he is in a very precarious situation here. He's under control of somebody else. He's thrown on this ship. They're in this ship, you know, lost at sea. Then the ship breaks up, and they swim to shore. So it's like one thing after the other. Paul gets through it. And then look what happens. So let's read this here. I'm sorry. 28, 1 through 6. Rachel Messner, can you read that for us? Chapter 28, 1 through 6.
And when they had been brought safely through, then we found out that the island was called Malta. And the native showed us extraordinary kindness. For because of the rain that had set in and because of the cold, they kindled a fire and received us all. But when Paul had gathered a bundle of sticks and laid them on the fire, a viper came out. And when the natives saw the creature hanging from his hand, they began saying to one another, undoubtedly this man is a murderer. And the
thank you. Again, looks like a random thing, right? That this would get him. But it doesn't. What evidence is there that this is an actual miracle? It's hanging from his arm. They expected him to get sick and die, which indicates they understood what snake this was. And anybody with any sense knows what snakes around you are poisonous and not poisonous, right? And these are called, in the Greek here, barbari. It's a Greek term like for barbarian. So these would be people who would not be sophisticated people in Greek culture. So they probably were very much tied to the land, which meant they knew their creatures. And they expected him, and even they have an interpretation of this, because they know there were some prisoners there, because these centurions, understand, you know, we see police and the military, very distinct. And even in this country, there are state and federally mandated separations and distinctions and so forth. The Roman military was the police force. It operated oftentimes like law enforcement, as much as it did a military, in military units. So they've got these prisoners with them. And so what do the natives conclude? That Paul what?
It was a murderer.
Because they expected him, that this was something terrible is going to happen to him. He's gotten bit by the snake, and it's justice is finally caught up with him, even though he escaped, you know, perishing at sea. Through the eyes of the Maltese people, Paul should have died. He doesn't. He shakes it off. In light of the other miracles in the book of Acts, and you've been saying it, you know, before I got here, how would you compare and contrast this with other miracles? How is it different? I mean, we studied about Eutychus the other day, and before that, the maiden in Philippi and the earthquake and all those kinds of things. Yes?
Well, other than Philip vanishing in front of the eunuch, this is one of the only times that we see a miracle happen to one of the apostles.
Happens to him. Okay. Right. He's delivered from death, as like he'd been casting out demons and healing sick people and raising Eutychus and so forth. He's the recipient of the divine power and protection.
And in front of a large group of people.
Yeah, and they're witnesses. Yes. So he is the benefactor to this. Interesting. What else do you see in contrast to the other miracles?
I can't help but wonder if he was taken by surprise.
No. Right.
He initiated others, but maybe this one.
Right. Right. Okay. What he experiences is not an unusual phenomenon, that a viper, a snake, latches onto someone. I mean, obviously, you know, you're working with the wood and you're disrupting its nesting or something like that. This is not an unusual occurrence. It's not something that happens every day to every person, but this kind of thing can happen. Step in a hole, get, you know, stung by a bee, or a tree limb fall and hit you in a windstorm. I mean, these kinds of things happen. And so this is not something orchestrated by Paul, nor anyone else. This is a natural phenomenon. What's supernatural is he's protected from the poison. Yeah. How else would you compare it? I mean, a lot of the miracles are what, you think, in the book of Acts?
Healing.
They're healings. And this is, in a way, a healing, in a way. Maybe he's just protected, he's immune to the poison or something like that. However, God does that. However, most of the healings in the book of Acts take place how? Somebody's just laying there sick and all of a sudden they get better? How do they usually happen? Yeah, the apostles come around, or somebody who's been given a miraculous spiritual gift. Like we saw with, Paul resurrecting Eutychus and the lame man that Paul healed in Acts 14. Okay? So this is like a healing or a protection, but it's not through a human agent, is it? It's not through an apostle or some spiritually gifted person. This is directly from God. And I think that's one of the keys to understanding how this story fits in to the larger narrative. And this is God protecting Paul. Now, when Paul is not, when Paul doesn't fall over dead, what's the response of the natives?
Oh, God.
Yeah. What does that remind us of? One of the first ones that we studied together, that I studied with you. Something happens with Paul, and they interpret it that he's a god. Do you remember? That's right. When Paul and Silas healed the lame man earlier in the book of Acts, and they thought that they were, you know, Zeus. Remember, thought Paul was Zeus, that Silas was Zeus, and Paul was
Hermes.
That's right. Thank you, Hermes. This is very similar. So that tells us about that these people are very superstitious, but quick to see a supernatural act and attribute it, like we saw before, to a divine force, though they're misdirected in believing in, you know, the pagan idea of the gods and so forth. We cannot help but to go over to Mark 16 when we encounter this event. So go over there with me. And as you're doing that, let me set it up a little bit. This is one of the texts where Jesus has been crucified, he's resurrected, and he's commissioning his apostles. This is also a section of the book of Mark, and if you've done any kind of study of the book of Mark, or maybe some studies about the manuscript evidences of the New Testament, what books, you know, and so forth, this is one of the most disputed sections of the Gospels. The earliest manuscripts don't have this section. Latter manuscripts do. That's why some Bible translations include this, but with brackets or footnotes and things such as that. I would say this about that. That's a pretty in-depth topic. That everything contained in the latter part of Mark 16 is not weird and unusual in the New Testament. It is harmonious with everything else that you're seeing in the New Testament. And I think that says something. And that it was included later on says something too. But I want you to look at this with me. Verses 15 to 20. Les, will you read that for us? Mark 16, 15 to 20.
And he said to them, "Go into all the world and preach the gospel to every creature. He who believes and is baptized will be saved, but he who does not believe will be condemned. And these signs will follow those who believe. In my name they will cast out demons. They will speak with new tongues. They will take up serpents. And if they drink anything deadly, it will by no means hurt them. They will lay hands on the sick, and they will recover." So then, after the Lord had spoken to them, he was received up into heaven and sat down at the right hand of God. And they went out and preached everywhere, the Lord working with them and confirming the word through the accompanying signs.
All right. Thank you. Look at the pairing of what is said in verse 20. In verse 20, what is paired that we have seen paired over and over in the book of Acts? The word preached, confirmed by the signs and miracles and wonders. Stated right here. Again, very consistent with everything else in the New Testament. And he says here, in the focal point of while we're looking at this, is what it says about the believers, starting in verse 17. Signs will accompany them. What are the signs? What were the signs listed in order? Cast out demons. Okay, let me ask you this question. Did every single believer in the New Testament cast out demons? No. It's not something that happened all the time anyway. What's the next sign that's listed?
Speak with tongues.
Speak in tongues. Did all believers have the gift to speak in tongues? No. Paul makes that abundantly clear in the first letter to the Corinthians, doesn't he? Chapters 12, 13, and 14. What's the next one? Pick up serpents in their hands. And the next one? Drink any deadly persons that will not hurt them. So those go together, drink the poison and the snakes. Do we know of any incidents where they drank poison and were not harmed? Don't know of any. We can assume that it happened because of this statement, but we don't have a record of it. But here's the point. Just like with tongues and any other signs, the sign of miraculous knowledge or prophecy or healing or whatever that you see listed in 1 Corinthians 12 and 1 Corinthians 14, you got to take all of this on balance with other revelation on the signs and the miracles. And that is, miraculous spiritual power was limited. Not every believer received these powers through the Holy Spirit by laying on the apostles, and they even received different ones, the ones who got them. Which means believers spoke in tongues, cast out demons, were bitten by poisonous snakes, and were not killed. But not every believer. Believers experience these things, and as they preach the word, these signs confirm their message. But not every believer. Now, you may or may not know where I'm going with this. If not, you need to get one of those documentaries about snake handlers. You know, I grew up in the mountains, but you know, this is a big city to me. Now, I've been living in big cities, but where I grew up was a tiny town, okay? And my uncle had a water filter service, and he serviced filters in Virginia and eastern Kentucky and southern West Virginia. And he had a customer who was a snake handler. He was a charismatic preacher who handled snakes. And me and another worker, some before I went to college, had to replace his water filter in his basement that was located right here. And right behind us were two boxes full of copperheads and rattlesnakes. And I didn't get any extra pay. We were so nervous that one of us watched the boxes and the other one work, and then we'd take turns. Not one of us always had our eyes on those boxes. So there are people who actually believe, and in worship services, to show their great faith, they will actually bring in poisonous snakes and handle them and lift them up. And this guy had been bitten and had gotten sick before. Really sick. According to his wife. I never met the guy. I just met the snakes.
There used to be a preacher over in
Canada. Okay. North Carolina. I know eastern Kentucky, southern West Virginia, and some places in East Tennessee.
Used to be.
Has it been some here in the mountains of North Carolina? I'm a little rusty. Used to be.
He died.
Okay. Natural causes or?
The snakes.
Oh, the snakes. Got it. Okay. Not unusual. That happens. And here's the other thing. Okay, now I'm curious. I'm going to start researching to see the snake handling in western North Carolina. So it's been heavier in southern West Virginia and eastern Kentucky and some places in northern Alabama. But here's the deal. This guy had his own snakes. Paul reaches into this wood pile and gets a snake on his arm. That's a different situation, isn't it? And they actually have the snakes as pets, in a way. So, we'll look at this. I think it's next Wednesday night. Do miraculous things happen today? First of all, that we can see this. That the things that people claim to be miracles today, it's like apples and oranges to what you see in the book of Acts. And in the Bible, period. It's very apples and oranges. Les, what did you want to add?
Well, I just happened to see something a week ago or so ago. There was a photographer who goes in deep in the mountains into some of these isolated places and takes photographs of the mountain people. And he also does interviews with them, videos. And one of the guys that he did recently was a snake handler, a preacher. And in the course of the interview, some people may have seen this photograph because I have actually seen it before I saw this video. But it's a fellow with his hand up in the air with just oodles of rattlesnakes hanging out of his hand, and that was the photograph they took. But in the course of the interview, this preacher told this gentleman that his father was also a preacher, and he died from snake bites. His brother was also a preacher. He died from snake bites. And the individual himself, whom he is interviewing, had been bitten 5 times, and every time he got deathly ill, but eventually got better.
What a contrast. Let me flip back over here. I was in Mark. And they were waiting for him to swell up or suddenly fall dead. But when they had waited a long time and saw no misfortune come to him, they changed their minds and thought that he was a god. Apples and oranges. I mean, it's more like apples and bowling balls. Not even fruit. It's very different. Harmed or not harmed? It's opposite. So, thank you for the anecdotes, both of you, very much. So, that's Mark 16 prophecy is what you see here in Matthew, in Acts 28. It's what you see. Earl, did you have something?
Well, I was just going to say, and I might be jumping ahead of what you're going to say, but in one case, the gentleman that Les was talking about, someone who's tempting God.
Yeah.
You know, and whereas Paul's not tempting anybody, he's just reaching into a pile of sticks.
Right. Which is the point that you were making, that this happened to Paul. He actually received the benefit of the miraculous power, but it's not like he was using it on himself, you know, to prevent cancer or something like that. This was directly from God that he's protected this way. It's totally random. Totally random that this happened to him, but it's not random, is it? I mean, it really is not. Which is really the point that I want us to focus on here at the end, and that is, this is an incredible thing that happens, and just like the raising of Eutychus and the earthquake, and, you know, happening and surviving, there's another aspect of divine force in Acts. And it's God's providence. I mean, just real quick, let's let PowerPoint work for us here. And actually, I generated this list before I even got to that point, that we would end to that point. Look at all these things happening to Paul. Oftentimes beyond his control, many of them bad. Including getting bitten by this poisonous snake, okay? But he survives it. And you remember what was said there when Paul relates the vision of the angel that assures him that no one's going to die in the ship, you know, lost at sea? Why was Paul supposed to survive? What does it say? What does it say in that text? You remember? What?
You must stand before Caesar.
Do not be afraid, Paul. You must stand before Caesar. That was God's plan. And I was going to throw this out. We're out of time. Acts 28, he gets to Rome. And a group of Jews come to him. They've heard of him, but they're not prejudiced against him. And he's able to preach to them. And we're told that the last statement of the book of Acts is Paul is in house arrest, and people can come and go, and he's preaching in Rome. We're told in Philippians chapter 1, he's writing that letter from Roman imprisonment. He has two. The second one he doesn't survive. The first one he does. And he writes, beginning in verse 12, how it's all turned out for the furtherance of the gospel, and even the praetorium guard has heard the gospel. Those are the ones who are Caesar's elite military force. It's like the Secret Service and the soldiers at Fort Belvoir, Virginia, rolled into one. They're Caesar's army. And Paul got to proclaim the gospel to many of them, and it spread among them. Paul's going to get to Rome because God wanted him to. Doesn't matter if there's some mob, some Roman governor, some Jewish council, some storm on the sea, or some snake. It's not going to stop it. And that's where we are connected to this flow of events. Not the miracle part, not the miraculous part. But we know from scriptural teaching that the great force of the providence of God is at work in our lives. For God to accomplish His will, to strengthen souls, to spread the gospel, to accomplish His purposes. And that force is in our lives. And that's a lot to be grateful for and aware of. Okay, thank you very much.